Italian cuisine is the world's most popular and also one of Australia's favourites. Made at home in our kitchens, savoured in a ristorante, or simply enjoyed on Instagram. No doubt, Italian food is a celebrity. But there are also regional specialties, best discovered and loved right there, perhaps not far from the lands that produce their ingredients. And then there are others. Dishes that are only shared in the family or in the most traditional restaurants, which do not often end up on Instagram. They're rare, confined to small areas, sometimes illegal, but on the other hand, they're beloved, truly part of some Italians' identity. It's just that no one else knows about this food. My name is Massimiliano Gugole, and in this SBS Italian podcast series, I'll tell you the story of six dishes.
A little bit disgusting, actually.
I like it too much.
Oh my God, yuck!
Delicious.
Ugly, perhaps, but that offer an unprecedented portrait of Italy, Italian cuisine, and the love of Italians for food. Let's take a closer look at these ugly ducklings of Italian cuisine. In this episode, we head to Verona, famous throughout the world for the story of Romeo and Juliet, immortalized by William Shakespeare. You might also know it for the Arena, the Roman amphitheater that still hosts beautiful concerts and a summer outdoor opera season every year. Pandoro also comes from Verona. Together with panettone, it's the most popular Italian Christmas cake, and you can now find it in every corner of the planet. Yet if you ask a Veronese which is the most iconic dish of the city, the answer is almost invariably the same. Pera. And what's that?
Pera.
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 It kind of looks like a sauce or something that, like, you dip stuff into it.
Pera. No. Pera. No.
A very browny, greyish, gravy type food?
Yeah, I would try a tiny little bit and see how I go.
I don't know, it doesn't look too tasty.
Really tasty.
It's a peppery, bready sauce with a colour and an appearance not so inviting, but with an enveloping flavour, which tastes of family and simple pleasures. Today we'll talk about pera with Guy Grossi, chef and owner of several restaurants, including Florentino in Melbourne and Garum in Perth. Welcome, Guy.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on with you, Massimiliano.
Fantastic. So let's start from the basics, if you like, Guy. Let's start from the name. Do you know what pera means?
Pera is a very important thing in the cucina veneta. And since, as you know, my mother is from Verona, we grew up eating la pera. And it's generally always with boiled meats. You know, the bolito misto, or even just if it's a single boiled meat, it's a delicious foil to a beautiful, rich, fatty meat like that. It's pepperiness, it's spice, but also the texture is something that in my household we've grown to love so much. It's kind of, I'm gonna use some terrible words here, but it's kind of a gooey, dunky texture, which sounds awful, but it actually is really pleasing on the palate, believe it or not.
I believe you, because I'm from Verona too, so I've had that a few times myself. And actually, pera comes from pepper, from per, which is the Veronese dialect for pepper. Do you remember the first time you had pera, Guy?
Look, I think I learned to eat pera by osmosis, and it's very hard to pinpoint the day, the first day. I was probably a very young child when I was eating it. But as I said, it's always been a real staple in the household. And my mother always used to tart it up a little bit with some grana to give it a little bit of extra flavour. And I know that's an age-old argument about the pera, whether it should have the grana in it or not. And there's different schools of thought on that.
So you're in favour of it?
I'm in favour of it. I love it. I think it adds a really lovely dimension to the sauce, and it adds a lovely bit of richness to it. But of course, you know, the argument is, you know, it comes from the peasant style and la cucina povera. So if it's coming from la cucina povera, how can you have, you know, the grana in there?
That's right.
Yeah, but it's an age-old argument. I think we can have pera now from la cucina povera e la cucina ricca.
Absolutely. And also, in fact, in the past, during my research, I found out the pepper was quite expensive too. So, in fact, pera itself with so much pepper is not so much a cucina povera dish, because it was precious already thanks to the pepper.
That's correct. And don't forget the long cooking time for making the brodo. because a good piara has to have a very, very excellent brodo to start off with, because all the depth of flavor and the layers of flavor, of course, the pepper is what takes precedence because it is so bitey and so strong. It's not just spice. It has a lovely, delicious depth of flavor to it as well. But without the beautiful brodo to start off with, you can't have a great piara. It's like anything else. The primary produce is the first thing that comes to mind when making a beautiful dish like that, which is so simple as well. It's such a simple dish, so there's nowhere to hide with it. It's got to have great fundamentals. The beautiful pepper, which you say was something which isn't really cucina povera as well, and I agree with that. Through my own research, I've found that argument as well. But also, you know, having the time and effort to goes into the brodo, it makes it also something which is not just a quick thing to do.
Piara seems like a peasant's dish made with simple, inexpensive ingredients, so much that some say that cheese should not be added to keep things as basic as possible. But in fact, even bread wasn't so common in the poorest families, much less pepper, a spice so precious as to be called black gold. Piara seems to combine humble elements, such as bone marrow, with noble ones, like pepper, pleasing all Veronese regardless of their income. It perhaps for this dual identity between poverty and wealth that piara has become a dish for everyone, but usually reserved for special occasions, for Sundays, the day that many Italians still like to spend with their families. Let's not forget, it's a dish with aristocratic origins, and even nowadays, in Verona, every year, the Duke and Duchess of Piara are elected for the city's carnival, custodians of the ancient recipe and responsible for the future of this very Veronese dish. So whether you're a princess or a peasant, if you're from Verona, you'll have stories attached to Piara. These are from a Veronese in Melbourne, Amita Piazzi.
Piara is something that really reminds me of home. It's almost like the social binder of our family. Something that reminds me of the coziness of being at home. I have this image of Christmas morning, and we start talking about piara for days before Christmas, and then we all go and we have this big lunch, and after a couple of first dishes, there would always be the bollito, the boiled meat with piara, and we love it. It is that good that you can eat it even in the middle of summer. I'm very proud of this. It's one of those things that I can be a poster girl for, piara. Even if it's so not well known, you know, like nobody outside of Verona in those 40Ks of the circle around the city, no one knows. And I'm thinking, how is this even possible? Once you eat it, it's so good that you even forget about what it looks like. It is that good. And it's got a flavor that it's really appealing. It's subtle, but it's got a kick. It's multi-layered. It's beautiful to see. Absolutely beautiful. My partner is from New Zealand. And the first time we went to Italy together, we were invited at my auntie's for lunch. I requested, because every time that I go to Italy, I ask around who is going to cook piara for me, because I have to have it when I go home. So my auntie was the designated person, and we have been talking about it for days before going. And then we arrived, and he took a couple of spoonfuls, and he was like, oh yeah, that's gravy. It's like gravy. I just went, what? How dare you? Like, and still to this day, when I hear him saying, oh yeah, yeah, piara, it's like gravy, I'm like, oh my God, don't even say that. It's not like gravy. It's so much better.
Hi, I'm Guy Grossi, and today we're talking about la piara.
Have you ever thought that this dish perhaps is a bit ugly?
Well, yeah, it's not the most attractive dish in la cucina italiana, I've got to say that. But sometimes things that look really homely and really, when you say ugly, they're ugly to some, but in their appearance, they can look beautiful as well. It's like, you know, if you look at a beautiful bowl of pasta fagioli or a pot of pasta fagioli cooking, it doesn't necessarily look beautiful in the sense that it's a beautiful, you know, has a beautiful dress on, but it actually looks beautiful in its own homely, casalingo sort of way. And I think the piara is something which is like that as well. Of course, in a restaurant setting, like when we serve it, it's kind of difficult to get it onto a plate and looking great because it has got a, you know, that sort of brownie tinge of colour to it, and it's kind
that
of...
That texture you're describing before as well.
Yeah, that gloopy texture. So generally when we do it, if we're doing a bolito misto, for example, upstairs in our restaurant, which is, you know, more luxurious, we might do, you know, a few different meats on the bolito and present them really well on the plate, and then we might pour the piara at the table. So, you know, you're getting the service of pouring it at the table, but also you've got a nice presentation. So there's a few different ways of handling it. And some would argue, especially the Veronese, would argue that it's always with the boiled meats. But of late, well, not of late, from a few years, I've been using it with other things as well. And I think it really goes well with, say, un polastrino, you know, and a nice roasted chicken, and it really, or a guinea fowl or something like that, even if it's not boiled but roasted, it goes really well. It's just a beautiful flavor that marries nicely to those sorts of things.
Nice. So there's a few suggestions there already, and we'll talk about the recipe in a second. Before, I want to ask you, can we make piara here in Australia? Do we have all we need here?
Absolutely. We have all the ingredients here. We've got good grana. We've got great pepper. You can even get some different imported peppers, but local pepper is fantastic, our black pepper. You just need the time to make a good brodo, either chicken or manzo or beef. In my household, it was generally chicken that we used, but if you're making a bolito, the meat that you cook the bolito in is generally the brodo that you will use for the piara. So a little bit of time to do all that, but the ingredients are all there. You need clean water, you need the parmigiano if you're going to use it, the pepper, some stale bread which can be turned into crumbs, to thicken the sauce, and seasoning, and that's it. And I put a little bit of olive oil in as well. So it really is simple, but in its simplicity, it's also really delicious.
So you're not using the bone marrow then?
I put bone marrow. Sorry, I forgot the bone marrow. I put a little bit of bone marrow in as well, which you can get easily from your butcher. You just ask the butcher to cut your marrow bones in half lengthways, and then you just soak those in water for a little while to remove the bone marrow. It helps remove the bone marrow. You get the bone marrow out and cut that up into little pieces. And just before you thicken it, pop it into the brodo, let it cook in the brodo, and then thicken it with the breadcrumbs and parmigiano, a little bit of olive oil, which I think adds a really luscious sort of shine to it as well, and a little bit of flavor as well. And that's basically it. I mean, it's a really simple thing.
Fantastic. Guy, would you like to just run through the recipe once again from the start, please?
So I start with my brodo, and I bring that to the boil. I then chop up my bone marrow into really nice small pieces. I mean, if you want it a little bit bigger and have it a little bit more chunky, you can, but I like it nice and fine. Pop that in there and let the bone marrow cook in the brodo. Then it's time to thicken the sauce with my breadcrumbs. I always do my breadcrumbs nice and fine. So if they're not fine enough, you can put them in a food blender or something and make them a little bit finer. That actually helps with the texture of the sauce, as we mentioned before, that sort of grainy texture can be, you know, not quite so attractive, but if it's a little bit finer, I think it looks a bit nicer. And then you put your breadcrumbs in slowly, whisking till you get the desired consistency, which is of a, like a runny sauce. You don't want it too gloopy, you know, it's not a polenta, you know, it's got to be like a sauce. And then once you've got that and you've thickened it up, the pepper goes in. In the typical Italian recipe, quanto basta, or however much is enough, because everybody has a different palate. I like it quite fiery. And then I let that cook so the bread cooks out nicely, probably only about 10 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes, stirring occasionally because low heat, because now it can stick to the bottom of the pot and you don't want that, otherwise it'll burn and give the piara a terrible burnt flavour. We don't want that. And then to finish, un goccio d'olio, a little bit of olive oil and parmigiano to taste, and then just bring that all together and you have a beautiful rich sauce which will go really well with many different things.
Traditionally, I read from the recipe that you should use a terracotta pot. Do you do that, or is it not so necessary anymore?
We use stainless steel here, and it works just fine. So if we use terracotta pots here in Massimiliano, we'd have to go to the shop and buy new ones every day.
Not very convenient for a business, I understand.
That's right.
And how was the piara born? We must go back to the first centuries of the Middle Age in Verona, some 1500 years ago. One day, King Alboin killed the father of his wife, Rosmunda, and unbeknownst to her, he offered her a drink in a cup made from her father's skull. Rosmunda, distraught, stopped eating. She was determined to let herself die. It was then that the court's cook created a dish so good, so irresistible, that Rosmunda had to reconsider. Yes, that's the legend of creation of Peara. And it sounds like Rosmunda had a lot of it. She found a lover, El Miki, within the entourage of King Alboin, and together they killed the king. Peara gives superpowers. The love story then continued between Rosmunda and El Miki, with a kind of Romeo and Juliet ending, but without love. They poisoned each other. Could it be that, as they had left Verona for Ravenna, Peara had lost its magic? Who did you learn this recipe from? Was that your mum?
It was from my mum. That's who taught me to make it the very first time. And, you know, as I said before, you kind of learn by osmosis, because when you're in the kitchen, as a kid, you know, you're sort of mucking around and doing whatever, but then you have to start helping, right? Italian household, and your mum is there cooking, always they make you start doing some work. So, and it was there that I first learned. And I believe that my passion for cooking came from that home kitchen as well.
And if I'm not wrong, one of your books was also dedicated to your mother's recipe, and Peara was one of them.
Yes, that's right. It's Recipes from My Mother's Kitchen, which has been out a while now. She was definitely an inspiration, and that's why I dedicated the book to her. And also, it was just a way of showing the story of migration or immigration through the lens, I guess, of an Italian boy growing up in the suburbs of Melbourne. It's a story of when my father, I should say, first came here in 1960, he left my mother and my then older sister behind. She was a very young girl, just a baby. He wanted to come here to check if it was nice here, nice enough to bring them before he committed to bringing them over. And they ended up being separated for about 7 months. And they wrote to each other really, really often. And one day my mother gave me these letters. They were all part of yon, you know, the blue paper, if you remember, that they used to write on back in those days. And one day my mother, when I was older, gave me those letters and I translated them. And there was a very deep story in those letters, a story of hardship and love and happiness and devotion, but also a lot of stress and a lot of pain. And I thought to myself, gee, it must be a really big deal for somebody to just, you know, pick up from where they are, their lives, and come to a new place to start a new life and do all of that. I thought, you know, that story is a story which is not just an Italian story, but it's a story of all immigrants that move to another part of the world and they devote themselves to another country and establish themselves to raise a beautiful family, but also to give that country a new layer of depth because of their presence in that country. So I wanted to write the book of that story through the eyes of myself growing up in the suburbs of Melbourne and through the food that we ate from loving parents. And that's why the book came around and I dedicated it to my mum, calling it Recipes from My Mother's Kitchen.
And talking about Italian identity, you know how Italians are usually conservative. When I interviewed Paul for this podcast, she used a word that I liked very much, which was immovable. So we don't like, you know, variations so much. You gave us a few hints before, but do you make variations on the recipe? And does that make you feel guilty because Italians really should do things just the right way?
There's different ways of looking at that. I think that identity is so important. It's really important. And tradition is important too. The tradition must be respected because we have such a rich culture, especially in our cooking, but in many things, the arts and all of that sort of stuff as well. But I also think that innovation is important. And I believe in innovation done in the right way can be something which is great and can be held up on a pedestal just like tradition. But I don't think innovation should be just for innovation's sake. It needs a dish, if it's going to be called an Italian dish or have an Italian identity has to have the pedigree. It has to have the passport and a postcode. It's got to have a reason for existing. So, you know, a variation on a dish is fine, but it needs to be declared. I can't bring myself to making a bucatini matriciana and not making it real. I will call it something different if I vary it, and I will declare it, because it's important that we keep our tradition alive and well. But that's not to say that, you know, it can't be a shackle. We can't use tradition as a shackle. We must be able to innovate. If we are in a place that has various ingredients that perhaps aren't readily available in a particular place in Italy, then it would be very un-Italian not to embrace those ingredients. Because, as you know, if you're a little restaurant in a countryside town in Italy, you will use a local cheese, you will use a local wine, you will use everything that's local around you. That's the Italian way. So if we're in another part of the world, then we must embrace local ingredients.
You mentioned before that Peala sometimes is available also in your restaurants, or during the years you've presented it to many, many people, many Australians not with an Italian background. How did it go? How did they receive it?
Massimiliano, it's a mixed bag, that one. Some people embrace it lovingly and straight away without question. And some people look at it and make an expression on their face like you wouldn't want to flee. So it is actually mixed. And I know many people that absolutely hate it and don't like it. And people that have it, they've had it and grown up as well around it, but they don't like it. But you know, it's bad luck for them, because as far as I'm concerned, it's one of the great sauces in Italian cucina.
So you insist, you keep presenting it every now and then in your restaurants?
Absolutely. During the winter, we use it a lot. Not now in the season, because we're not really having things like bolito on, but we do use it quite a bit, especially during the winter.
Thank you so much to Guy Grossi for revealing this very Veronese secret, Peala. Thanks, Guy.
It's an absolute pleasure. Could talk about it all day.
In the next episode, travel back in time to Renaissance Florence, Firenze, and try the most secret part of chicken. Follow the Ugly Ducklings of Italian Cuisine in your favorite podcast app or in the SBS radio app. This episode was hosted and produced by me, Massimiliano Gugole, with support from SBS Italian executive producer Magica Fossati, as well as Max Gosford, Rachel Sibley, Caroline Gates, and John Dexter. A big thank you to the SBS Food team for their support as well. For more SBS Italian content, go to sbs.com.au/Italian.